384, which had the ability to oscillate up to approximately 150 megacycles. So this little radio that was out of Popular Electronics was a super regen. Was it super regen or was it just regen? It was a super regen. Super regen radio with a single 2N384 transistor as the oscillator, RF amplifier, detector, audio output, all in one. It worked on a tiny little earphone, and I seem to remember it ran on a pair of penlight bells. And you had a slope detector. In other words, you tuned it a little bit off to one side of a local strong FM radio station, and you would hear FM broadcast out of a single transistor radio. And that was kind of a fun project in 1962. You could buy transistorized AM radios, but not FM. It just didn't exist. The transistors didn't go that high. And I remember bringing that into Telephonics and showing it to the engineers. And I thought they were going to be really impressed with it. They took one look at me and said, what magazine did you get that out of? In other words, they knew it wasn't my design. And so I didn't get as much credit for that one as I thought I was going to. So I think I had more fun showing that to the people at Pratt Institute than I did showing it to the people I worked with at Telephonics at the time. Go ahead, Howie. TQRIW in the TechNet.
Well, there, Dick. I didn't put my own gear, but I had a Clegg Venus. You there? My battery died. K2RIW, copy?
Sure do. We did hear that you had a Clegg Venus, and I think the Clegg Venus was a synthesized rig where you would tune the receiver dial until you heard somebody strong, and then you went into the tune mode, brought the transmitter dial up to the same frequency, lined a couple of knobs, as I remember, and then went into the transmit mode. I think that was the Clegg Venus, if I've got it correctly. Go ahead.
So the Clegg Venus was a 6-meter single sideband rig with a DFO and an RIT. It used a 6883, not a 6146. The 6883, which was a 12-mode version, it used a 60W4 RF front end. I got that in 71, bought that used from a guy. But I also owned the TR6. I owned the Zeus. I owned the Clegg. I owned the Clegg 22 Mark II. Remember, I had a 621 VFO. Never owned a Johnson 6 and 2. Had an R4B, had a T4XB. And I remember, I think the noise blanker was a plug-in. It was a 5-transistor. They had the schematic. I think it was 5 transistors. It was a very simple noise blanker, but it worked pretty damn well, Dick.
You're absolutely right. It was a separate plug-in. But I think it did squeeze inside the same package of the R4C. Maybe not on the T4XC, but on the R4C receiver, I seem to remember, and I own one yet to this day. I think the noise blanker squeezes inside of the package. The other nice thing that the R4C had was a tunable IF, and it was done inductively. In other words, there were 2 or 3 coils all ganged together, and as you turned the dial on the front panel, that was a tunable IF, you were moving slugs in and out of 2 or 3 coils in the IF strip. So the IF strip could be tuned higher or lower, and therefore you could emphasize the high notes or the low notes of a single sideband receiver, of a single sideband reception, whether it was an upper sideband or a lower sideband reception. It had a bunch of crystals. In other words, it took the 80 to 10 meter frequency region, and by plugging in the right crystals, it down-converted. It was a tunable IF down-converter receiver. Very nicely done. RF, a tracking RF front end, a separate dial on the front panel that did that. And so that was a very bulletproof receiver. Properly used, it had no image response. Very high dynamic range. My only complaint is the tubes would go a little bit soft in time and have to be replaced. But other than that, that's an excellent receiver. And as I said, I like that receiver so much, I never sold it. I still own it. Whatever happened to your R4C, Howie, go ahead.
Never owned 4C. I had an R4B. I had the R4B and the TF. All I remember, it had the blue guy. I used to get fascinated by the blue light on that thing. And it had like an orange light on the default, you know, on the receiver transmit. Then in the 70s, Drake came out with a, I think I was called an RV4 that came out with a synthesizer. You used to add 11 megahertz or something to the frequency that you wanted to listen to. And if I remembered right, the default, which was a PTO, you know, a linear, and like a linear tuned oscillator, that ran from 5 to 5.5. Also, Dick, I didn't do this, but I knew a guy who took an AM broadcast radio, you know, the old American 5, and he took some windings off, and he made it to an 80-meter receiver. I saw a guy taking a typical broadcast radio, a 5.2 AM radio, and make it into an 80-meter AM receiver.
Yeah, I fell into that around, let me think now. I guess it was 2 years before I got into ham radio, roughly 1954, 53. We had an old 5.2 AM radio sitting on the kitchen table, and I started fiddling around with the tracking controls on the RF front end of that. And I soon realized I could tune it to the image frequency, and it would tune across either the 160 band or the 80 meter band, I'm not sure which. But I was hearing ham radio operators, as well as marine operators, but ham radio operators. I remember doing that once, 4 o'clock in the morning, and saying, what is that? What are those guys doing? They seem to be having a good time. I got into ham radio for, I did the right thing, but did it for the wrong reasons. Me and my buddy, who went to high school with me, named Robert Nielsen was his name. He and I used to be on the telephone for ridiculous lengths of time, like teenagers do, discussing cabbages and kings and everything else, occasionally girls. And the family was always complaining on both ends that they couldn't use the telephone. So we decided to get into ham radio so we had a private way of talking to each other. We lived 4 blocks apart. So we find a way to talk to each other with ham radio, and that way the telephone was free. And that became an occupation, electronics. Before that, I was into model airplanes and mechanical things, and suddenly got enthralled with electronics way back in 1955, 56 time frame. First time Rob and I took the exam before the FCC examiner for general class. Novice class was issued by W2RZ, a guy named having trouble thinking of his call letters right, his name, Whiskey 2 Romeo Zulu. The guy who lived in Farmingdale, who gave me my novice exam. And I think he was about 75 years old way back then. But he knew electronics. And a couple of months later, after studying with a code practice oscillator, a transistorized code practice oscillator, schematic diagram again came out of Popular Electronics magazine. Bob and I would send Morse code to each other day in and day out. And we got up to what we thought was 14 or 15 words a minute. And we went to the FCC examiner, and we took the exam and failed the Morse code miserably. Turns out we had taught each other a peculiar kind of Morse code. We had a swing to it where we had very fast letters and big spaces between the letters is the way we were sending Morse code to each other. And the first time I heard machine sent Morse code at 748 Federal Building, 641 Washington Street in Manhattan, I said, what the heck is that? Seemed to me like all the letters were run together. We probably got about 10 letters of copy during the 5 minutes code test. We suddenly realized there was a different kind of Morse code than what we were sending to each other. And we started listening to W1AW. I think we bought a code practice record. I think there was a code practice record in those days. There was no tape recorders. This is the dark ages. Tape recorders were a laboratory curiosity. There were wire recorders, but not tape recorders. And I don't know if you could buy pre-recorded wire. I don't think so. I don't think you could buy a cartridge or pre-recorded wire in 55, 56. The tape recorders, as I said, were considerably later. And the second time, Bob and I took the general class license exactly 1 month later. We had no trouble passing it. And in those days, you took the Morse code test first. If you had failed anything, you weren't allowed to take it for another 30 days. Went back and took it again. And in those days, the written portion of the exam, you had to draw out schematic diagrams of a Hartley oscillator, a Colpitts oscillator, a power amplifier, a receiver low noise amplifier, and so on, a Cascode RF front end. You had to draw those schematic diagrams as part of the exam. We had memorized an awful lot of it. We didn't know what the word joule. We knew what the word watt meant. Ampere, volt, and watt. We understood that. We didn't understand Weber's, lines per square meter, joules. Hadn't the vaguest idea what they were. We simply memorized those and spit back the memorized answer. Much later in life, I found out what that was in engineering school. And joules are very, very useful units. Just that it wasn't explained to us in the vocabulary that we could understand. So there are people who are unhappy about the fact that a person passing an exam, multiple choice or whatever, does it with memorization, doesn't really understand the information. It's half or two-thirds of what learning is. Memorization is not bad. As long as you follow through at some later time and find out what the words you memorized really mean. That's an opinion. Did you have to do any memorization when you passed the exam, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the second net? I think that was JFF, but you were either overmodulating or very weak. We're only copying you 50%. But JFF, speak a little softer and a little slower and try again, sir.
And I just wanted to add the fact that back in the 46, 47 when I got my license, general class is the only one that you can get that is no novice, and you could not get the caveat was that you have to be advanced just to go on 20 meters, correct?
So you had to be an advanced class license just to go on 20 meters, and there was no novice. And I think you said 47, 48. How about that? 46, 47 is what you said. Yeah, we've come a long way from, and the extra class license in those days, I think you had to have a general class for 5 years before you were even allowed to apply for an extra class license. So, boy, things have changed. Back to you for any comments on this, Mel. K2RIW.
W2 Japan Express, Fox 10. The name is Clarence for your information. I won't hold it up, but yes, I remember most vividly that I was a general, then I got to be an advanced, and then they changed it that everybody could go on, the generals could go on immediately. Thank you very much, Dick, for letting me get in. And information is always useful. And going down memory lane is always sometimes good to know. Bye-bye.
Yeah, where are you located, sir? What's your QTH?
I'm located wide at the present time, and we're in the car, right?
Okay. And what? So you're in Wyandanch and you're in an automobile, and that's why we're hearing some USB. Okay. Back to you, Mel. I bet you remember some of the license requirements. I think novice license was created in the mid-50s, I believe. In the beginning, I think it was only 80 CW, 40 CW, and 2 meters. I think later on they added 15 CW, which I believe you mentioned earlier. But I think the first novice license, I'm going to guess, was around 1955, 56. What do you think, Mel?
2 meter AM, 75 watts.
but the portion of 2 meters you were allowed to operate with a novice was 145 to 147. You didn't have the whole 144 to 148, if I remember correctly. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Novice was actually, I believe, created in 1951, if I'm not mistaken. I believe the first one came up there when they, the first was K2, just about when they started issuing K2. And so the KN2. They did some reissuing later on with WN2 and things like that, but initially they used KN2 as the first novice, so I believe it was around 51, if I'm not mistaken. And, yeah, what can I tell you? That's right, you went down to the FCC, and you, you know, you memorized a lot of stuff, of course. Who the heck knew what the heck 13, I didn't know what the heck Japanese jazz was all about, really. CW I was pretty good at, because my father was a CW operator in World War II, so CW wasn't really my problem. But, when you went to your general class, like I say, you drew schematics and all that good stuff. A few years after that, about 1960, I took a friend of mine down to the FCC to take his general. By that time, of course, we were giving the novice licenses another ham that had at least a general class license. Give you the novice exam. So I gave him the novice exam, and I says, he said he's ready. I tested him, you know, I worked with him, a good friend of worked with my father at the time. And went out to take the general, and while I'm sitting there, I said, you know, the gentleman there, that's Finkelman, Finkelstein, I says, well, you know, about the extra class license. And he says, what would you want to bother with that for, you know, doesn't give you no privileges. I said, I don't know. I know of it and everything and all, and I wonder, is it possible to take it? He said, sure. Like, when we finished giving the CW for the general class, and then he said, I'll crank up the machine. I figured if I copied the CW, I don't think I'd have any problem with the theory, because already I was, you know, quite deep into this jazz, as you say. And so that's it. So I got my extra class license. About 59 and 60. Now, the funny thing is, when I got the extra class license, they issued a diploma. You should see this thing. I didn't realize that if you were within the first 1,000 people to get a extra class license, that they would issue you an 8x10 beautiful old, like the old radio, you know, operated, the radio licenses of old. They were like a big diploma that hangs up on a wall. And that's what I got. I was very surprised. Geez, so I still got it hanging on the wall, very colorful and all. And everybody says, what the heck is all that? Never saw it out like that in amateur radio. Just, not unless you go back to the old time. But that's what they issued if you got your extra class. I guess mine was 9. I think mine is marked 900 something. I was just under 1,000 people that had extra class license at the time. As far as 2 meters go, yeah, I got involved with 2 meters early with using Fletcher wire type device. And of course, RCA had come up with a gadget called the NuVista, which could work quite well on 2 meters. So I remember building something and built a rig with a two NuVistas in it. They were a little type of vacuum device. I can remember the little one. I think the number was 60. W4, if I'm not mistaken, yeah, 60W4. And the record you mentioned about CW, that was a Vico, something called a Vico, but they produced a CW record. And of course, the popular 2 meter radio at the time, if you could afford it, was Gonsant. The Gonsant, they used to dictate that the Goonie Box 2 meter transceiver, quite something for its day, 2 meter transceiver. Even though that there was the original, because the original during World War II, which one I happen to have in my collection, was the when they came out with this 2 meter transceiver for World War II. I can't remember the name of it now. I can't say. They'll come back to me in a minute. Company here, Bromco, Brooklyn here produced a two-meter transit receiver in 1943. And the whole idea was that they were going to put one in every precinct. That's what they did. They put one in every precinct. They figured just in case we were attacked, and they knocked out the regular phone communication, that amateur radio volunteers that were in that time in civil defense, air raid wardens, they were called air raid wardens, would man this rig that could, it was a battery-operated piece that ran off an A battery and a B battery, and they'd have two-meter communication between the police precincts. What the heck was it? Was it the Bronco? Funny, I can't remember the exact name of the radio. I'd have to really look here. I got the original documentation on it. But that was the story, basically, back in those days. That was 1943, first 2 meter commercially produced transceiver. Had two separate, and it was two VFOs. You could do a receiver and a transmitter, but built into one box, Dick. K2RIW and the TechNet station.
Oh, the color of the cabinet was yellow.
Yeah, were those things called Goonie boxes now?
Oh, that's Gonson. That was later years. Gonson, this is way back. This is way before Gonson. It's 1943 I'm talking about when they produced it. The yellow Gonson, that was the Gonson communicator that they produced for 2 meters and then produced one for six. The yellow one was the civil defense, had CD written on the side. This was not. This was World War II I'm talking about, 1943. And it was operated by air raid wardens, Dick, over.
So you couldn't just use an unskilled person, so to speak. Well, what am I trying to say here? I think the tube on the Gunson, wasn't it a dual tetra tube, an 832? And I think it put out something like 25 watts. Is that approximately right?
2E26.
Sounds right. 2E26. How about that? And a multiplier chain for the local oscillator for 2 meters, which was, to my knowledge, a little bit noisy. An awful lot of the signals you heard on a Goonie box sounded kind of noisy. Was that a regen receiver or a super regen receiver, if you happen to remember, Mel?
Boy, now you're going to test me. I don't remember much about the Gonson, but I never really owned one. But I don't remember what kind. I know they had a separate, it was actually a receiver that you could actually take out of the box, you know, take out of that casing. I remember the tuning eye. It had a 65 green eye for tuning. The crystals, I remember, in the transmitter was double, triple. They had a double and double, triple. I think there were 8 megahertz crystals, if I'm mistaken. It was crystal-controlled transmitter. The receiver had that little dial on it, the sensor thing, and I remember there was a whole bunch of, you tuned a lot of different stages in it, the transmitter. But a lot of details sort of faded away. I just remember, you know, once in a while seeing, you know, schematics of similar homebrew versions. There was a lot of homebrew versions. But, you know, the 2E26 was a tube that came along during World War II. So they showed up surplus after that quite a bit. And the real, real 2 meter rig that I had that was really, I really got up in the world when I got myself a 522, Mark 522. That was a tank unit that weighed, I don't know, 200 pounds. You could rest your front of your automobile on it. I think you could use that as a horse for your front of your car. That thing was literally bulletproof. And had a bunch of motors in it that had electric tuning. Oh, it was a whole contraption. And a lot of hams got on 2 meters with that, the 522. And it was big, just huge. Everything was big in those days. We didn't worry about size and weight, the steel chassis, steel cabinet, you know, it all worked. So that was my first 2 meter rig, Dick, over.
Dick, superhead receiver, not a lot on the Goonie box.
Okay, so the Goonie box was a superhead receiver. Transmitter, I think, ran on an 8-meg crystal. It takes the 18th harmonic of 8 megacycles to get you to 144. So 18th harmonic probably means there was a tripler, and a doubler in order to do that. So three stages of frequency multiplication, probably another stage of amplification, another stage of oscillation, all for the local oscillator, for the receiver. I don't know what the front end tube was, but I think people used to call it a rush box. It always made rushing sounds because of the high noise figure. So it was a super heterodyne. How about that? And I should have realized that because of the frequency multiplication for the 8 meg rock to operate the transmitter. And I'm guessing it was a similar set of crystals with similar multiplication for the receiver, with the first IF being something like 10.7 or 21.4. What's your guess as to what the first IF was on a Gonset communicator? Back to you on that one, Howie.
Don't remember. I was just a kid. I remember seeing it at the Red Cross. It had like a brown knob on it. It had the green eye. I do remember that. I remember one guy had a separate DFO for it, and it was 8 meg. Even the Clegg 22 was used in 8 meg. I didn't know the 2E26s went all the way back to let's say, the 40. I remember the Lafayette HA460 used a 2E26. 2E26 was used in the Clegg 66er and the Clegg 22er. Now, just for your information, do you know what an 8150 is by any chance, Dick? A little test piece. You know what an 8150 tube is?
Is that one of those I-type tubes that closes as you tune into the signal?
No, an 8150 was like a 6146 or a 6083. It was a high-frequency tube. It ran about 40 watts in, got about 30 watts out. It was used in the Clegg 22 Mark II. It was made by RCA, and RCA wouldn't stop making it. Clegg, in his wisdom, must have got a buyout, must have got a lot of those tubes for very inexpensive, because the Clegg 22 Mark II used that. Also, the Clegg 22 Mark II used an RCA dual-gate MOSFET, I think a 40736 or whatever it was, and it used a dual-gate MOSFET in the VFO. The VFO on the Clegg 22 Mark II was a solid-state VFO, and the Clegg 22 Mark II came out in 1969 and was built for about a little over a year. It was a solid-state receiver with a tube transmitter.
How about that? Had a comment, but I've forgotten it. Oh, well.
W-A-2-N-E-Z.
Mr. N-E-Z, start up with your name, and what was the good old days like for you, sir?
Well, my name is Henry Hank, and I'm 85 years old.
Okay, Hank, Mr. N-E-Z, 85 years old, and what was your first transmitter, Hank?
I think his battery's died.
Could be. Maybe he's got another battery. Maybe he's going to plug it in later. Are you back, Hank? No, Mr. NEZ is not back yet. I'm trying to remember what was my next transmitter.
I had an ICO 720.
Yeah, those ICO kits, weren't they sold by the Arrow? No, the Allied catalog. Isn't that where ICO is sold, in the Allied catalog?
I didn't buy my kit. I bought it brand. I bought it used over at Harrison Radio. Do you remember Harrison on Hillside Avenue in Queens?
Didn't go to that one. I went to the Harrison Radio in Farmingdale. And there also was an Arrow Electronics in Farmingdale. But Harrison Radio in Farmingdale, as far as the Suffolk County people is concerned, well, the Nassau-Suffolk County border, right on Route 110. Boy, that's where you went for everything ham radio-wise. Magazines, batteries, components, rigs. They had a ham set up there on demonstration all the time. With a, I think it was row number 6 tower out in front of the building, about 60 feet of tower with a rotatable antenna, a tri-band beam on the top of it, if I remember correctly. You probably never got out to Route 110, so you went to the Harrison in New York City. Is that true, Howie?
Yeah, I went out to Harris on the Island. My father drove me, but I remember the kid growing up in the 60s riding my bike over and playing with all the radios, the Swan 250s, the Swan 500s, the Swan 500s, the Hex, wanting all that equipment. I couldn't afford it. Finally got my old man to buy me the Drake equipment. I had Drake. I had a Clay 22 Mark II. I never owned the TX-62. Do you remember the TX-62, which was a 6-2 meter rig with cathode modulator, was made by Amico?
I owned one, and I put a very reactive diode, a very capped diode, across the 8-meg crystal in order to make that rig run on narrowband FM, and used that for a couple of years on 2 meters. I think it was amplitude modulated. Either, I think the original rig was amplitude modulated, and I went to FM modulation, narrowband FM. So for a lot of years, I was telling everybody, when you tune to my signal, tune a little bit high or a little bit low in order to get the audio, to get slope detection, because FM demodulators and receivers were very unpopular. It didn't exist. You had to build an outboard unit to get FM demodulation, which is something I had to do, by the way, to listen to the Apollo astronaut, an outboard FM demodulator. As I remember, where I was using a, I think it was an ICO receiver. I think it was an ICO receiver, an 80 to 10 meter receiver, which was the tunable IF for audio when we were listening to astronaut audio. That particular ICO receiver didn't have very good voltage regulation on the IF strip and on the local oscillator. So if you tuned a little bit off to one side on a strong signal, the amplitude modulation of the signal you're listening to would change the current drain of the tube in the IF strip, which in turn changed the voltage on various stages, which created a small amount of FM oscillation of the local oscillator in the front end. So if you tuned on the high side of a signal, the receiver would break into oscillation. If you tuned on the low side, you wouldn't have that problem. What a receiver. But it worked. I think it was the ICO that had that characteristic, Howie. I wonder if you remember that.
No, but you remember the ICO 750 trait? It was an 80, it was a 40-15. It was a really thrifty radio. Never owned it, but I've seen it. Wasn't a big fan of ICO equipment. I had a Swan 250 for a while. Borrowed it from a friend, and that was a thrifty radio. That used a couple of 6146s. But I'll tell you, the Clegg Venus was, that was a nice, 6-meter transceiver. I wanted a TR-6, but didn't have $1,000 to buy a 6-meter, radio. I wanted a Drake TR-6. That was really a TR-4, you know, a 14-meg radio with a converter in it. It actually ran a triple, 3 6JB6s. Drake made a lot of nice gear. It made a TC2, which is a 2-meter converter. It made a TC6. It made a solid-state converters. And then you had Vanguard that made receiving converters. I can go back in all those days. Then you had Heathkit that made the Pawnee. You had a Heathkit. You had the Allied, or the Nightkit, TR-108 and TR-106 was a 2- and 6-meter radio. Remember all that equipment, Dick?
I just realized now that it wasn't an ICO receiver, it was a Knight. Knight was the brand name of the receiver, 80 through 10 meters. And that's the one that had this oscillation characteristic, unless you put some kind of a voltage regulator on the voltage going to the IF strip, which I'm not sure. I think I made some of those modifications downrange. I wish I could remember the call letters and the full name of Mr. Clegg, who lived in New Jersey, ran a very nice company making all that Clegg equipment. And what's the call letters and name of the man who built the Drake equipment in Miamisburg, Ohio? These were real engineers. Any idea of their call letters or name, Howie?
Absolutely. Ed Clegg. I don't remember the guy's called. I spoke to him. What a nice guy. I remember I had a problem with my Clegg 22 Mark II. Got into the car with my old man. We drove all the way out to New Jersey on a Saturday. We called him up and Ed said, yeah, I'll come into the office. He came in, he took the radio. He said, I'll fix your radio. I'll have it back to you in 3 or 4 days. Those are the days, and guess what? The guy didn't even charge us. I had the radio a couple of months, three, 4 months. Something happened to it. I was a kid. My father drove me out to New Jersey, and Ed took care of it. Ed said, okay. Ed came out. You know, that's the day when the owner would come out on a Saturday, and, you know, he took the radio. He said, okay. He said, I'll have it shipped to you. No problem at all. It'll be, you know, UPS or whatever. Got the radio back in perfect. Ed Clegg. Oh, you're talking about Drake. Robert L. Drake. R.L. Drake. Miami, Birth, Ohio. R.L. Drake. That was it. I actually have, laying in my room, a Drake catalog, a 1969 catalog. I won't get rid of it because I dreamed about all the gear. I couldn't afford anything. You know, I had a TR, an R4, BT4X, but I wanted a TC2 and a TC6. Well, that would have run into thousands of dollars worth of gear, Dick.
Yeah, Drake also is one of the very early producers of satellite receivers. Television receive only, TVRO as it was called. You know, the tenor is a 12-foot diameter dish, and S-band reception, 3.8 to 4.2 gigahertz. And Drake made a very nice so-called extended threshold receiver. So these were real engineers, real ham radio operators, Clegg and Drake, R.L. Drake. I think he said it was Robert L. Drake and Ed Clegg. Rings a bell. And a real trivia expert probably could come up with their call letters. So the impression I'm having, and it's true then and it's true today, you want a person who really understands electronics. You want a person who really understands radio and wireless techniques and transmitters and antennas and receivers and feed lines and standing wave ratio and all that jazz. You hire a ham radio operator, particularly one who's enthusiastic. There was a short period of time there where ham radio operators in the United States didn't have a great name because they had quite a little bit of a reputation for stealing components in order to support their projects at home. They were called G-jobs, government jobs. That was the slang used. So for a short period of time, ham radio operators didn't have a great name, but we've gone through a few cycles of that. In Europe, if you got a ham radio license not too many years ago, you were treated as if you had an engineering degree because it took a pretty serious set of requirements to be met to demonstrate the experience, and in fact, a number of countries, you weren't even allowed to apply for ham radio license until you approved that you were a shortwave listener for a certain length of time and proved that you were really dedicated to the hobby or to the technology. The United States never respected its hams quite that much. But still, there are very few people who are good at wireless technology, radio technology, who don't have some kind of a ham radio background. That's my experience. And the school I went to, the school that Howie and I went to, Pratt Institute, gave us the degree by which we could call ourselves officially an engineer. But only a certain percentage of what we learned came from that school. A significant percentage came from our ham radio experiences. I'm pretty sure that Mel, I, and Howie share that. I'm going to pass it to each one of you guys. I wonder if that's reasonably true in your case, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW, and the reminiscing technical net. You got it, Mel.
Yes, K2KEY. Well, first of all, I've only had one interest, and I'm not fooling. Kids go through, you said, model airplanes and all that stuff. Not me. I was always in the radio. In fact, my mother had a picture of me that was taken when I was about 3 years old, Dyson. And we had a big old Venus console radio there with a big spinner knob in it and a picture of me tuning it. So she says, I'm never surprised that you went into it because you were fascinated with that radio from the time you could walk. That's all you ever did is tune that radio back and forth and all. I used to love to see that needle go back and forth. And that was it. I was stuck. It had shortwave on it. I used to listen to 160 amateur radio operators, 80 meters, AM, of course. And I was hooked that from that time. And then I built the crystal radios. I was 6, 7 years old. I was putting together a crystal radio and so on and so forth. By the way, that that radio I told you made 1943, I just dug out the original article on it. I knew I had it in the file here. There it is. It was the QST reviewed in June 1942. And it was Abbott Instrument Company. Ultra high frequency transmitter receiver used. Units have been incorporated in emergency communication network and standard equipment. This is for the police auxiliary to be used in case of emergency. Built by Abbott Instruments, 8 West 18th Street, New York City. And I said they built the rig right here at New York City. Ha ha, you like that. And Harrison Radio, first time I went to Harrison Radio, they had one place that was on Broadway. And then they moved over there to DC Street, then right there, Cortlandt Street, that was after Broadway, but originally on Broadway. And then I saved up some money. You talked about Drake, this and that. Well, I saved up some money. And I got myself a Johnson Viking 2 in pit form. That was some rig. I still got it. That's what a rig it is. I use it once a year. We have the, what they call the straight key night. That's where the guys get on, you know, with the old straight key. I use my father's World War II key, straight key. And I used the Johnson Viking 2. And I did it later years. I added a national receiver called the NT-303. Now, the original receiver that I kept, I got out of that stage of using ARC, you know, ARC. That was basically my receiver for surplus. The ARC series, ARC. I had an ARC 5 and all. I picked up a receiver. Never forget. The receiver had been in a building that was on fire, and it was a lot of smoke damage and water damage to it. I patiently took apart. Now, this was a receiver. It was a Harman HQ-129. I took that thing patiently apart, stripped it down, really, put everything apart on it, I got the schematic on it, and cleaned it all up. I made myself a really good... I thought it was a terrific receiver that time. Palmer was a receiver. So, I can go on and on and on. I had so many radios and all. And, of course, I always Google that Harrison radio, the display of Collins. From the 50s on, that was it. That was the radio of choice. It had the money with Collins. And eventually, that's why I wound up with about 9 Collins rigs here, because I fell in love with them. And that someday, if I could afford one, I would have it. And a friend of mine once said to me, he's unfortunately a good friend that also started ham radio, same age, and passed away from cancer just a few months ago, Joel, K2HXS. And he said, he was standing in Harrison Radio, said, if they said, just pay for the knobs on that radio, you could have, and they give you the rest of it for free, you couldn't even afford the knobs. And later on, I once invited him to my shack when I bought that whole setup, and I said, so, he says, it's funny, and last time I spoke to him, oh, my God, just a couple of years before he passed on, and I said to him, he says, you're going to forget that? I said that to you when we were 16 years old. He says, you still remember that? I said, you gave me the inspiration to study, to go on, and to buy these stuff. Inviting things, so it shows you how, you know, how things influence you. K2RIW, K2KY.
Quick question, Mel. What's the name of the town in Iowa where Collins was located?
Cedar Rapids.
You got it. I couldn't think of it. And you saw this great big horn antenna in the Bill Orr VHF handbook, demonstrating the huge horn they use for transmitting signals from Cedar Rapids to some other place 1,000 miles away, I'm not sure where it was, when they're doing early experiments in meteor scatter. And meteor scatter has been used significantly throughout the years for military purposes, because it is one kind of radio propagation that, although it's sporadic, nothing in the world stops it from happening. You could have a nuclear blast that wipes out the ionosphere, and still you'll get a signal from point A to point B by meteor scatter if using the right equipment on both ends. And as long as you don't want the message to be immediate, as long as you can wait around a little bit and send it in packets. Meteor scatter communication equipment for military purposes, it is my belief that was the origin of packet radio. What do you think, Mel?
Could be. It had its origin. Listen, CW was the first really type of, really actually a digital type communication. So after that, packet RTTY, you know, came in. I remember getting involved in RTTY very early. I managed to pick up an old script printer, a Western Union script printer. That's when they made telegrams. They used to put it on a script tape, print out, and then paste it onto a sheet of paper. That's the original telegram. So they were dumping those 2B, called the 2B script printer. And so I got a hold of one of them, and that's when amateur radio first started with RTTY. And they then got the Western Union also was then replacing them with the page printers, such as Model 10, 12, and all that became very popular. I had a number of them. I still got a teletype machine, because radio teletypes are old. I got here Teletype Corporation. 28 ASR upstairs in the shack, and once a year I copy the, for extra credit for field day, I copy the field day bulletin on it, so we get extra credit for that, so every so often I turn on that clunker, and it was quite fascinating for its day, Dick. I guess I got into just about every kind of communication, you know, as it came along, and of course after radio teletype, got involved with slow scan. I had ATV, you know, but the slow scan was the most fascinating. I happened to have met up with Costello and McDonald, W0LC, at that time, who invented the slow scan, and he got me involved with it. He was here in New York at the time, called me up because he said he had heard of me, that I do a lot of homebrewing and all, and he wanted to know if I'd like to get involved. And so I was one of the first 10 that built the slow scan system, built it actually on an old 30 black and white chassis with a flying spot scanner and all.
Did you say RCA 630?
Yes, 630. RCA.
That switch is giving you some more trouble, Mel.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm trying to through a book here at the same time. Yeah, it was a 630 chassis, and I built the slow scan scanning unit, the flying spot scanner on there, and what the heck else did I do? Oh, and I built the, of course, the receiver, used a 5AP7, was a green box for, I believe it was the coupe that used in radar World War II. That was the way most of the slow scanners, so I started out as one of the first 10 in the slow scan, and we got special privileges at that time granted to us by the FCC to do the on-air test on 10 meters. So that was quite a fascinating, when I could see pictures going back and forth, you know, Dick, this was really quite something. K2RIW, this is KTY.
Anybody remember the Robot Company?
Yeah, Robot made a very nice close scan TV converter, if I remember correctly, Howie. You mentioned earlier, Mel, with radio teletype, you were using a 28 ASR. Not too many people nowadays know that ASR stands for Automatic Send Receive. And I think it was the 28 ASR was the terminal of choice in the early days of timeshare computer. I think it was the General Electric Company, somewhere around Ohio, had a huge computer, and by telephone you dialed into it, and with radio teletype-like techniques, you sent signals over the phone line to this computer, and it processed your program and sent the results back. The timeshare computer days. That was in the mid to late 60s that was going on. Also, you talked about a Haviland HQ-129. I bet it was called the HQ-129X. I think it was the most popular model of receiver from Haviland in those days. Back to you for some comments on those, Mel.
Well, the HQ-129X was already the civilian version. The military got the HQ-129. That was a rack mount. That's the one I had. The Teletype, yes, 28ASR was the epitome of the Teletype machine at the time, built by Teletype Corporation. Had a built-in, what we call a reperforator for punching tape. Had a built-in TD, that's the tape reader. Had a very nice system, you know, of interchangeable typing heads with a typing block that you could pull out because they were used for different ones. There were ones that were used in the National Bureau Weather Bureau that had a special typing head for receiving bulletins on weather conditions with special symbols. And it had what they called stunt box that you could put in there, all kinds of things that like non-overprint, automatic carriage return line feed at the end of the at the end of the paper. And it had lights that lit up and all kinds of things, some consoles, a big piece of equipment. And so I used that for many years, the 28ASR. And what did you ask me? Did you ask me one other question about, the receiver, the HQ-129. That was the military version, and it was for rack mounting. So the robot that Howard just mentioned, that came along much, much later in slow scan. We were already on slow scan a number of years, and then K6IZ, that's, I remember him, Bob. He was a good old buddy that I met, and we had a lot of discussions, and I had showed him my slow scan setup, and he said he was going to see if he can solid state the system. It was all vacuum tubes, all the slow scan equipment, and he came up with the robot, and he started robot, and then branched into closed circuit surveillance equipment, making multiplex units, you know, sequential switches. But I know him quite well, K6IZ at the time. Great engineer, really knew his electronics. Nice guy about our age now. And as far as what happened with Teletype, I had a friend, in fact, he's 99 years old now, K4PT with W2OCL here in Brooklyn. He had a daughter that was deaf. And she had her own apartment, and he always said, there must be a way I can communicate with her. Well, I demonstrated RTTY to him. And he says, can this be sent over phone lines? I said, of course. I said, it's how Western Union does it. So he managed to get a hold. He contacted, you know, Western Union and surplus machines and everything, and that's how they started the Teletype network for the deaf. Using basically what I was using for amateur radio takeover.
Fantastic. That 28ASR, when that did a tape perforation, was that 7-level code, 7 dots across the tape? And later on, was there an 8-level code? You could call it 7 bits per symbol or 8 bits per symbol. With 7 bits, I think you've got 128 possible states, and with 8 bits, I think you have 256 possible characters. So, which one was the ASR, 28ASR, Mel, go ahead.
Well, it was a 45 board system, and it used 5 levels, and of course, all letters were capital. When you shifted, when you threw that, button that shifted the thing into the second quadrant, that was with numbers and special notation. Everything was really, in other words, uppercase was for that specialty of numbers and things, commas, you know, things like question marks. And when your carriage went down to lowercase, that was all letters. It was, you know, called the green key monster. And it used 5 level. There's a control in it. It's a shift control. It's a transmission in there. It's got in it, I think, 60... 75 and 100 words to be a gear ratio. So you just shift it. Well, we only had 60, of course, in amateur radio at the time. And, of course, you also had to have CWID. So they had a thing in there called the a wheel, automatic ID wheel that I readopted up, took that apart, what a nightmare. And reground and a little, in other words, there was like a little drum and these little clips, with, you push them out and you can make codes. In other words, that was the auto ID for the station. So I modified that over so that I could have my CW ID because you had to, you know, identify yourself in those days on teletype. When you signed over, you have to give your CW ID and regular CW tick over.
Amazing. How much later did the uppercase, lowercase, 7-level and 8-level machines come along now?
Hey, now you're talking about later on. That was the Model 35 they came out with. That was a plastic wonder. We called it a plastic wonder because Teletype Corporation up to that point was making everything made like literally. And you get a hernia, anyone to try to pick up any of their teletype equipment without help. They were heavy pieces of equipment. All of a sudden they came up with this plastic wonder with a lot of plastic gears and things in it. And that was called the Model 35, and that went there, and it started going to 7-level and all the higher speeds and everything. That was when they were changing over it to the newer equipment. And it never got caught on with amateur radio. Nobody in amateur radio at that time seemed to have to do it because already computers were creeping into the equation. And HAL Electronics, H-A-L, came out with their combination RTTY and PSK31 systems and all that jazz, you know. They came up with that system, HAL Electronics, and so amateur radio started abandoning the old teletype equipment to take over.
How about an AR-43?
Was it called AR or ASR? Howie, go ahead.
I don't remember. I just thought it was an ASR-43. They had one at Pride. It had yellow paper. It was tied to a PDP-11.
That was later on, the PDP-11. In my day, it was tied to a 1625 computer, as I remember, IBM 1625, with a punch card reader for programming. It spoke Fortran and, what's the other language? AFIT, Air Force Institute of Technology. AFIT, Fortran, and there was some other kind of very brief language. It'll come to me in a minute. Back to you, Howie.
So for that basic, I'm going to make a comment here. I want to digress for a moment. You asked me where did I learn a lot. I learned a lot from playing with radio. All that school did was give me the math behind it. I mean, it gave me the ability not to be a hobbyist, to think and design circuits using math and understand what was going on. But Dick, let me give you a little explanation of something as a kid, how things were. I was about 8 years old, maybe 9 years old. My parents had bought one of these AM/FM shortwave radios, like in 63 or 64. I'm a lot younger than you guys. I was born in 55. They had an AM/FM shortwave radio, and somehow we had also a regular AM radio in the house. I took a regular AM radio, Dick. Now, I didn't understand it at the time, but now I do. Obviously, later on I figured out what happened. I took an AM radio, Dick, and was able to find, you know, moving around with the 455, you know, moving the radio, I could make the AM radio generate a carrier, and I used an AM radio next to my shortwave radio to actually listen to sidebands. How do you like that intuitiveness?
That's pretty crafty. And I think you were using image as well as real response. So you did something somewhat similar to what I was doing, Howie. That's how I first heard 80-meter and 160-meter ham radio operators and marine operators. You've come a long way. Those radios in those days had in many cases, a selenium rectifier, later on a 5U4, well, there was even a smaller tube. The 5U4, I think, was the main rectifier tube that was used in television sets, occasionally a 5R4GY. 5U4, what was the other tube?
V4.
What was that again?
5 Victory 4.
5V4, that's right. 5U4 was the bigger one, 5V4 was the small one. In fact, I think it was a 5V4 that was on my 25-watt crystal-controlled 80 and 40-meter transmitter, CW transmitter.